We're here in the Congressional Corner with Congressman Antonio Delgado of New York's 19th District. Congressman, I know you are a guy who likes to be bipartisan, but I got to ask you, I suppose I would be not doing my job if I didn't. What do you make of this presidential race in the Democratic Party?
Well, I mean, you know, you're right. I don't really like to weigh into, political scenarios, particularly when they're beyond my control. I can tell you this, as somebody who went through my own Democratic primary in a very crowded field that was incredibly intense and, diverse in terms of points of views, I found the experience to be very helpful, not only for the candidates involved, but for the community. We were able to really, flush out a lot of different ideas. I certainly benefited from the experience and was pushed to make sure that I knew what I was going to stand for and have a real clear message. And I think fundamentally, you want to be in a position where, you say what you mean and you mean what you say, and that, you are being authentic to your purpose and to the community that you seek to represent. So the process itself, I think, on the whole, is a good one. And you want to make sure that multiple voices, diverse points of views are emerging, and that hopefully the individual that, comes out of it is able to unify the different camps.
Well, people are saying that the debates, for example, the so-called debates, I would say, are being hurtful to the Democratic cause because it just seems so chaotic. What do you think?
I mean, I think debates are a good thing. They inform the public. I went through quite a bit of debates again, and one, they sharpen the candidate, they make the candidate sharpen their own message, and I think they hopefully ideally illuminate or inform, I should say, the public to understand what each candidate believes and how to compare and contrast. I mean, we can't run away from working through the process of understanding different points of views, even if it could be messy, even if it can be uncomfortable. I think part of prioritizing truth is just doing exactly that, is putting yourself in uncomfortable situations, understanding that the objective here is to land in a place that makes sense to everybody, or at least majority of people, and that reflects or is based in, I would argue, sound reasoning, evidence-based reasoning, and some sort of objective reality. I mean, this is just a part of the process that we have to undergo. Otherwise, we're all just going to be living in bubbles, reinforcing our own points of views without any real attempt to figure out how to come together and shape our future in a collective fashion.
Okay, so do you have a choice among all the candidates, Antonio?
At this time, I don't. At this time, I don't have a choice. At some point, like all, Americans, I will have to vote. But at this point, that is something that I'm still deliberating.
Okay, you've had 35, that's a lot, of town halls so far since you took office. That's incredible. Does anything come out of these town halls?
Oh, of course. I decided to do these town halls in part because I wanted to make sure that I was connecting with the community that I represent. I could tell you now that I've been in Washington for a little while. If you're not constantly reaching back to the district, if you're not constantly on the ground connecting with the people you represent, you can come to Washington and easily get sucked into a whole other world that can distract you and keep you off your game. I didn't come here to be pulled into the sphere of special interests or lobbyists. I came here to represent the people that I serve, irrespective of party. And there's no better way to stay connected and informed by those individuals than through town halls. And I've done 35. I've done a number in each. I did three at every county in 2019, and I'm going to keep building in 2020. And so that's the one end, right? It's to inform me to do the job back here or when I'm in D.C. The other piece, though, is to reinforce, the people's connection to government. I think part of the problem with so much of, you know, where we are today in that political climate is that I think people in large measure have sort of written off government and don't view it as really an extension of people. They view it as an extension of the well-connected and the powerful and the wealthy, but not really an extension of everyday Americans. And that's a frightening situation. I think it's important that we, you know, attempt to do the work of reconnecting people with government, both at the local level, county, state, and all the way up to the federal level. Because if people start checking out of that process, it leaves a vacuum, and that allows people to exploit that vacuum for their own purposes. And oftentimes, those purposes don't reflect the general will of the people.
Okay, let me ask you about what everybody's talking about, their 401ks. Look, the market is precipitous fall. We're hearing it's a correction. What should we be doing?
Oh, about what specifically?
Well, what should we be doing? I mean, this looks like a real crisis that the markets are falling the way that they are. People's investments are disappearing. Do you have a plan?
I'm sorry, but are you asking me a plan to address the fact that the coronavirus is having an effect on the market?
Well, yes. Is there a way to do that?
Well, that's a complicated question. I mean, you know,
I'm known for those.
Yeah. I mean, this is a developing situation. I mean, you know, the way the market moves in many respects is it boils down to confidence, and you need to have confidence in the marketplace. And, you know, we are living right now in light of the coronavirus in a time where the global economy, the global market is, you know, going through a fragile period as a result of this emerging threat. So that's, you know, that's a part of the process. I think, you know, how one ought to operate in light of that fact, I would advise people to consult with their own financial advisors. I mean, I think that's, you know, you'd certainly want to be mindful of that and be thoughtful about, you know, the dynamics that are emerging in that regard. And I would just encourage people to engage with their advisors in that space. But beyond that, I mean, like I said, you know, earlier, when it comes to the coronavirus, we just have to be diligent in terms of minding our own health and just being aware of the fact that, you know, this is a process that is continuing to unfold, and we shouldn't, you know, make it a politicize it or make it a partisan issue, but think about just public safety at large and do whatever we can to protect ourselves from harm.
You just met with your advisory committee on, you know, the question of what the top concerns are. Can you tell us what's at the top?
Well, when you say advisory committee, I have four of those, sir. I have a healthcare advisory committee, a small business advisory committee, a veterans advisory committee, and an agriculture advisory committee. So we got a number of committees. We met with all four of those committees at the top of the year. These are bipartisan committees with representation from all 11 counties. And as you might imagine, given that each committee houses a different subject, the conversations are going to be focusing on issues that fall under those various subject matters. So I will say that, you know, the sort of thread between all of my committees that I connect with is the need to make sure that we are investing in our communities at large and that we are not forgetting about folks who live in rural communities. And I think that's the one thing that I have really come to appreciate in Congress, which is so much of what we talk about on a host of issues, from health care to broadband to economic growth, you know, to climate. A lot of it is not through the lens of rural communities. Farming, even farming and big ag and small ag they're treated the same. Family farms are lumped in with big farms. Community banks are lumped in with big banks. And in the end, you know, we're being left behind. And that's why, you know, introducing bills like the Rebuild Rural America Act, which I did, it's meant to sort of carve out our own space to access funds that would go directly to the counties and local actors, that would not go to the state, to allow folks to partner up and make investments in whether it's infrastructure needs, from transportation needs to housing needs, but just to ensure that we have our own pot of money. It would be $50 billion of block grant funding, multi-year funding on a rolling basis, that would be exclusive to rurally or designated rural communities. And I think that's the kind of approach we have to take in order to ensure that our communities have the resources to build their economies from the ground up. We can't wait for things to just trickle down. We need real investment across the board.
Congressman, it's been a delight to talk to you. It is clear you're working very, very hard.
Thank you, sir.
I do appreciate your coming on, and I hope we'll see you during the year. It'll be great to
talk. I appreciate you. Thanks for the time.